At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello and welcome into the 19th Hole Golf Show. My name's Ryan Ballingy. You can email the show, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Check us out on our website, golfnewsnet.com, or on the TuneIn Radio app under Golf News Net Radio. You can also check us out on Facebook and Twitter at twitter.com and facebook.com/golfnewsnet, or follow me if you choose on Twitter at Ryan Ballingy. We want to do a kind of a quick miniature-sized 19th hole today, because we saw an article this week, courtesy of JeffShackelford.com, that I otherwise wouldn't have seen, and it really piqued my interest, so I wanted to kind of have a quick 10 to 12-minute discussion about it, and hopefully we'll hear some feedback from you on what you think about the premise of this, and we can have a really good discussion back and forth, either through Twitter, Facebook, email, however you want to do it. But the piece is in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and it's written by Tim Grant, and Tim Grant's kind of taking a look the stock of private clubs in the Pittsburgh area. And in the interest of full disclosure, my in-laws are from the Pittsburgh area. They're kind of an hour east, which by Western Pennsylvania standards is very close. And they live right next to Latrobe, Pennsylvania, so where Arnold Palmer grew up. And my father-in-law belongs to a club there, the Latrobe Elks Golf Club. And a lot of organizations like that, military service-based organizations or service-based organizations, have golf clubs in Western Pennsylvania. It's a really unique aspect of golf up there, but they do qualify as golf clubs. They are like country clubs. They don't have the same level of facilities, at least in terms of amenities, but in terms of golf courses, I would happily put up any time the Latrobe Elks Golf Club against a number of the courses in the area. Anyway, I digress. There are plenty of great golf clubs that are the traditional, upscale, full-service, wipe-your-butt-for-you facilities. And a number of courses in the area between the private clubs and the public facilities are closing either at the end of this year or at some point next year. They've made that decision or they're on the verge of that decision. And part of that is there's just so much public golf in the Pittsburgh area that it's pretty easy to get lost in the shuffle. And so courses trying to compete against one another on no other grounds than what they understand have tried to cut prices. And so they've kind of run themselves into the ground price-wise. You can't come back up from that very easily. You don't make the investments in your facility because you don't get the money coming in. It's just a terrible spiral. It's a bad idea, and that's why a lot of courses are closing, and a number are going to close in the Pittsburgh area. But specifically to private clubs, you see the same things happening, especially in middle-class areas. And the club I belong to, Argyle Country Club, is more of a it's more of a middle-class facility, a club. The people that are members here at Argyle, and I'm about to go over there in about an hour from now, they're members because they've been able to work really hard at blue-collar work and earn their way in construction or paint or some kind of property management. They're not owning businesses that are worth boatloads of money. They may not even own the businesses outright, but they've put themselves into a position working hard through a good portion of their life that they have the disposable income and they have the love of golf that they want to be a part of this club, and they formed a bond that really has run Argyle from a place that was so deep on the wait list in the middle 2000s that the initiation fee was $10,000, $20,000 to the point at the lowest of the lows during the Great Recession where I joined the club for $750. Now, that initiation fee has gone up a little bit since then, but not really. And what the club has done to attract a younger group of members to replace the older ones that have passed away, they have created new amenities or revived amenities that bring families and people into the club. So they've renovated the bar and restaurant area. It looks wonderful. It's world class. It is a great place to go watch a game in an intimate setting on 6 TVs on a Sunday. And the pool facility has always been great, but they've made extra investments in that and promoting it. and the golf course built in 1945 has stood the test of time, and unless you bomb it 350 yards, you're going to have a hard time playing there on some days. So the facility is great, and it's a great community. And it, a lot of people tend to stick around a long time. I mean, I've played with people who have been members 20, 30, 40, 50 years. 50 years. And so they knew nothing else. That's of a different generation. Those are folks who are in their 50s or 60s. People who are joining the club, they're my age, in their 30s, in some cases in their 20s. I was in my 20s when I joined. Those folks kind of joined because they wanted a place to come play and they have a family. And so it kind of works out everything that they want to do in one spot. But I found that the trouble is, especially with job situation in the country, that there aren't a lot of people who are in my position who have the free time to be able to appreciate the club, or who are in a position to earn enough at our age that really have that disposable income, even with a family. It's tough. So the situation is very similar in Pittsburgh, and I know that just from anecdotal and personal experience. That is the makeup of Western Pennsylvania. There's not a lot of rich people. There are wealthy people, but there are not a lot of rich people, if that makes sense. There are people who are well off, who can afford these clubs, but there are so many of them, ranging from your Elks Club to your Oakmont Country Club and everywhere in between. And really, Elks isn't even at the bottom end of the scale. You can go down to the bottom end of the scale. Elks is kind of in the middle of the scale. And there's so much competition, and then there's the public golf, that it's just impossible. Places are going to close. So that's the state of golf in Western Pennsylvania, but that's not necessarily the point of this. The point is that coming out of this article is an auditor, Megan Hawk, at Three Lakes Golf Club, kind of feeds into this piece by Tim Grant and says she's seen a change in how people perceive golf after 9/11. And I don't think 9/11 really had anything to do with it. I think that generations have different things to do with. I think that the shift from the greatest generation to the boomer generation, and as we're starting to make the shift from the boomer generation to Gen X, you're seeing this kind of shift. And the quote, I think, is really interesting. So this is from Megan Hawk. "The game of golf was part of the success culture. It made people feel successful, especially if they belonged to a private club. They felt they had it made. Now it's not as closely linked to prosperity. Now it's more a form of entertainment than a status symbol," end quote. And then she goes on to say, is written by Tim Grant, "A lot of players, quote, want to collect experiences," Ms. Hawk said, quote, "They want to play six courses in one summer rather than the same one with the same people," end quote. I have no way to know whether she's right or wrong, whether it's regional or what, whether it's class-based, who knows, age-based probably. But I thought this was a really fascinating thing in it. And I think she's right. I really do think that Megan's right. For me, I belong to a private club not because I have a money or I want it to be a prosperity symbol. Neither. I don't have a lot of money. But I have enough money to be able to belong to a club that provides me and my family with entertainment in terms of dining, pool, tennis, and golf, things we like to do. I love to play golf. I work in golf. I need to test golf equipment. Not only is it good for me personally, it's good for my business and it's good for exercise to be able to belong to a club and literally walk through my fence and go play golf instead of having to phone up a golf course and ask, because I typically play alone on weekdays, is there room for me to play at your golf course? Yes or no? Well, usually you hear, well, come on out, and we'll fit you. And I don't want to be in the flow. I want to play quickly and get out. That's what I'm paying for at the club. Above all else is community, facilities, and the ability to play golf pretty much as quickly as I want whenever I feel like it. So it's not a status symbol. It is entertainment, and it's entertainment golf how I want it, which is great. And I think that's true for a lot of people. I think at a club like ours that is a middle-class club, there is a degree of networking that is involved. There's plenty of networking that's involved. And there's some back-scratching, just like at a higher-end club, just at a lower-end club. It's all the same. But I don't think that's as relevant to the younger generation. We're all friends. I mean, I know a lot of the younger guys. We go out and play. We have a good time. We play for money. We play for stakes. Whatever. It's good. But it's not there. We're not rubbing money on our chests as we play golf or lighting cigars with $100 bills. It's just not the case. It's not who we are. It's not where we're at. And it's not what we want. But at the same time, I don't know if I want to play six courses a summer in my local area. I can think of six that are within a 15-minute drive of where I'm sitting here recording this. I don't know that I want to go play those six. I want to go play the one down the street that I haven't played yet. It's called Northwest Golf Course because it's 7,400 yards from the tips. And I want to see what that's like, especially for a public facility. There's Hampshire Greens, which is in a housing development. I've played it a bunch of times. It's an okay course. It's nothing that blows your mind away, but it's okay. There's Norbeck Country Club, which is kind of a club similar to Argyle, except it's probably not prospering as well. There's Manor Country Club, which is a fascinating property because it's comparable to Argyle, but its membership dues are higher, and its initiation fee, at least based on what I paid, is 40 times higher for the same place, essentially, but nine more holes, an inner course that they have. Then there's Redgate Golf Course, which is managed by my former employer, Billy Casper Golf. It does a ton of rounds. It's a fun public course when it plays to its strength, when its greens go very well. And there are others. I mean, you can keep going. But I don't want to play all six of those. Not every summer. If I feel about golf, and this is going to lead into maybe a bigger discussion that runs 10 minutes. But I feel that I want to play. If I'm going to play six different courses this year, I want them to be blockbusters. I want them to be ones that make it worth it for me to play golf 4.5 to 5 hours or not longer and drive more than 30 seconds to do it. So for me, it's got to be a wow factor. Go play Potomac Shores. Go play Congressional. Go play Trump's Place, Lowe's Island, Avenel, Potomac Farm, whatever it is now. Those kind of places that are either high-end daily fee or even like Laurel Hill in Northern Virginia that held the U.S. Pub Links. It's a public course, obviously. Something like that. Like, the green fee is going to be higher. It's going to be $90 to $100 to $150 to $200 to go play. It's going to be a one-time this year thing, and it's going to be a great experience. That's what I'm going for. And if it's not locally, and I'm going to go play somewhere else, I'm going to play a place that's high-end, that's ranked by a magazine or a publication that says it's a really worthwhile course to play with a good designer. And I think that extends to how we feel now about golf course development. There's a decent chance this year that more golf courses will have opened this year than any time in the last 8 to 10 years. That's pretty wild to think about. I mean, we'll have to look at the final data at the end of the year. But when golf courses open in this country now, it's a big event. It's a big deal. There are only so many people that are in this business that are high-end architects. There are only so many places that are willing to spend the money to develop golf. And most of those places are either cities that have made a commitment to municipal golf, like Austin, Texas, and building a Coral Crenshaw course, or a guy like Mike Kaiser, who has Sand Valley in Wisconsin and Bandon Dunes out in Oregon, who's just adding to his properties and making more destinations for people to go play golf as a retreat, not as an everyday thing, but a special thing. And so when these courses open, even like the Potomac Shores one Jack Nicklaus designed in Northern Virginia, it's a big deal because this doesn't happen very often. And it's not like in the 90s and the 2000s when Johnny Appleseed was throwing golf courses everywhere where there was a new one opening every day, or the other statistic was there needed to be a golf course opening every day for 10 years to meet the demand. No. When golf courses opened back then, it was like, okay, this is another freaking golf course in housing development. No one gives a crap. And that's why those courses are dying, because no one cared about them then, and they don't care about them now. But the courses that are coming along now that are being developed in a new way, in a specific way, in places that have that kind of cachet by guys who have cachet or have developed that cachet, that it's a big deal. And I want to go play those places. I don't want to go play Nubs Golf Course down the street. I want to go play someplace that I'm not going to see otherwise outside of my club. I'm going to go see something I've never seen before. Or a place that's so great, so historic, that I'm willing to pretty much shell out whatever it takes to go play it, if I have the opportunity. I kind of want to hear about that from you, because you as a listener, you may be a club golfer, you may be a public golfer. You may want to play one place and you have a home course as a public course or a private. You may want to play all over locally. You may want to play all over nationally. You may be a traveler. You may not be. So I'm kind of interested in the feedback on this because I get the sense that Megan Hawk is right. I get the sense that what she's thinking isn't all that off base. And I think it does extend to how we perceive golf course development now. So I want to hear from you. Email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Check me out on Twitter, @RyanBallenge, Facebook, and twitter.com/golfnewsnet. Give us your feedback. I'd love to hear this discussion. I think it'd be a really interesting one to have offline off of this audio podcast. So that's it for us. Just kind of wanted to delve into this a little bit. And I appreciate you kind of obliging me on a bit of a different topic. We'll come back next week with a recap of Tiger Woods' week at the Hero World Challenge, what we saw, what we liked, what we didn't like, what this means going forward. Spoiler alert, nothing really, but we'll talk a little bit about it and what this kind of means as golf moves forward into 2015. And then after that, next week, the following week, in 2 weeks, we will do a recap show of the year, and that'll be our last of the season before we head into 2015. So until then, next time, next week, I'm Ryan Balaji saying thanks for listening to this shortened edition of the 19th Hole Golf Show.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key. And that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.